Here we go!
My valiant brothers, attend my words. Our struggle is righteous and shall call upon all of our strength. Death before dishonor. Fail not the Emperor. Follow me, my brothers, to the heart of chaos.
Now, your host, the Librarian.
Yes, I am back, bringing to you another episode of Fight Night, a podcast about Warhammer, 40K, Lord of the Rings, and Games Workshop hobby. I have survived the revolution that Global Smack tried to bring down on Fight Night, but we survived and we shall prevail. We got a good episode for you today. In the deployment zone today, we have none other than Jeff Crawley, Primarch, co-founder of the 40K Fight Club, also known as Hornblower. Jeff, how are you doing?
Awesome, Jerry. How are you?
I am outstanding. Got a little rope burn on my wrists, but I seem to have picked up a producer. She apparently thinks the $5 that Jeff gave her is the same salary that I'm going to pay her. But otherwise, pretty good.
Hey, $5, can't complain about that.
Right. That and a dime will probably buy a Coke to this day and age.
Small Coke.
Exactly. So, getting right into it, let's find out, as we've been asking everyone here, what were the origins of your user?
Oh, my user ID. Well, I'm a big fan of the Hornblower novels, actually, and the old Gregory Peck movie that came out. Oh, it's probably a 60s or a 70s movie. My dad was a huge fan of Gregory Peck, and so I watched that movie growing up with him as a kid. And I took that name, and I attached it to a Space Marine captain in a couple army lists I used to do back in third edition. And he pretty much just tore everybody apart. So when it came time to come up with a forum handle, it was just pretty obvious what the choice was going to be.
Captain Hornblower. Nice. Well, as I say in the book, it's a rather unfortunate name.
Very true. But he always did find a way to get out of the tight spots, though, didn't he?
Yeah, he sure did. So, you know, on the trend of unfortunateness, what's up with the Imperial Fist? Why do you find find that chapter so?
Well,
appealing?
You know, to be honest, back in the day, I had an old Space Marine army, even from first edition. I had the Rogue Trader 1 Beakies, and my first love was always Space Wolves. And ever since I cracked open the original hardcover Rogue Trader book back in the day, 1988, I just flipped to that page right in the middle that shows, you know, all what – I think there was 12 chapters of Marines there laid out, and it was a two-page spread. And I saw that logo of the Space Wolf sitting there. I said, now those guys are freaking awesome. And they had that killer – also the huge layout of the Fang, the Fortress. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I was just in love with them from day one. So I get my guys, and I get my paints, and I'm reading the little guide in the painting. You know, I'm like 15, you know, and I'm reading this painting guide on how to do it, and I'm trying to emulate how to paint a Space Wolf according to how Games Workshop says they should be painted, and I just couldn't get it. So instead of just calling myself the Blue Space Wolves, I ended up just making my own chapter, and I stuck with that for a long time. You know, well into a lot of third edition. And then as I grew as a hobbyist and I got older and my painting got better, I was ready to start, you know, delving into something new and doing something a little more challenging, a little bit cleaner. And I still wanted to stick with Marines. I love Marines. They're my first love in 40K.
Right.
And I had this guy I used to play like every single week. Every week we'd go toe-to-toe, head-to-head. He'd beat me down, I'd beat him down, just nonstop. And he always used to bring out this stupid army. It was called the Iron Warriors. And so I'm trying to think.
I know where you're going.
I'm trying to think of, you know, well, what should I do here? And then it was obvious. I play the freaking Iron Warriors every dang week. So why not make a Space Marine chapter of their nemesis, the Imperial Fist? So every time I beat his butt into the ground, he just had to see that clenched fist on a yellow backdrop, rubbing it in his face.
Nice. So obviously you're talking about the problem.
Absolutely. None other. Yeah. The infamous.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's actually a good transition. We heard Paul's version of how the Fight Club started. Give us a little behind the scenes. What really happened?
Well, you know, back in the crazy early days here in Lansing up at the Fortress, you know, it was pretty much an every Friday thing, and there was a core of guys that were coming up there who, I don't know, tended to take the game a little more serious than some of the other people, your competitive gamers, if you will. And so it just kind of ended up being the same group of 7 to 10 guys or so that kept playing each other every single week because they were the ones who would give each other, the most challenge. So we wanted to come up with a little something, kind of a private league, if you will, something to go back and forth with the same group of guys over and over again. And so we kind of put some feelers out to a few people if they would be interested in, making this private club where we have a little internet forum or really it was just a website back then, way before the forum, it was just a website. And we had a private Yahoo group that we used to email back and forth on. And so we started the Domination Table, which is pretty much the same thing in its incarnation today out on the 40K Fight Club. But that started as a little pyramid tournament based on these, 7 to 10 guys. I can't even remember exactly how many it was now. It was around 8, I think.
Okay. So we don't have any, Pirates of the Silicon Valley type of thing going on
here. No, not at all. It's really, really kind of lackluster and boring, to tell you the truth.
Well, I'm eventually going to get into the dirt. I tell you, one of these guys are going to eventually break, and we're going to hear about the drunken parties. And
the strippers are always a fun time.
Well, see, there you go. Now it's an interesting.
Yeah, get a
story.
Couple of drinks and Matt Cheval, and the clothes just start tearing off.
maybe that was too much. Okay. Well, that said, what about your collection? Do you have what is it you got that has not seen the light of day that some of the members might take an interest in seeing?
Well, if it's pretty much Imperial, I have it. As far as armies, I own Sisters, Grey Knights, Imperial Guard, 2 Space Marine armies. I also have an Eldar army. I can run a tank company. I have so many tanks. As far as haven't seen the light of day, I have some actually pretty cool Forge World Terrain stuff. Some of that, the Amphelion project base. Yeah, right. I have that.
And, yeah, that's a good.
You know, it's pretty awesome, but at the same time, it's freaking intimidating. You know, some of the pieces they don't want to really line up super smoothly, so it's kind of scared me out of assembling and painting. It's been sitting on my shelf for like 2 or 3 years, and I just haven't gotten the guts to actually put it together. Not to mention, a lot of my time goes towards putting together and painting things I can actually play with on a regular basis on the table. The terrain stuff ends up kind of getting shoved to the side.
Forge World is not for the faint of heart.
No, it's not. Absolutely.
I actually have a Reaver Titan, and it sat for about six months.
Oh, I'm jealous.
Before I got lucky. I got a good deal on it. I got an extremely good deal. Some guy bought it, and then he got intimidated by the assembly, and he sold it for maybe 40% of the real price.
Oh, wow. Lucky you.
And, yeah, I know. Well, it was on eBay, and the price was, buy now at this price with the bid, and I'm like, no one's done this? Bought it right there. Didn't even think about it.
Yes.
And then it sat for a while, me getting intimidated until I paid someone to
there you go.
For me.
You can't do it yourself, pay somebody, right?
Well, there are some things I just didn't want. I knew if I didn't, it would never get done.
Sure.
So it got done. So, what is it you think about the Spearhead with you having some Imperial armies? You've got to be pretty jazzed.
I am jazzed about this. The Prophet and I actually had lunch today, and we spent probably the first half of lunch talking about just how awesome these new models coming out are. And that Manticore is absolutely sweet. And the Death Strike, I kind of wish that the missile on top was a little bit bigger, to be honest.
I have the same feelings. Yeah, exactly.
Coming from an epic background, back in my really early days, I used to play a ton of epic. So anytime I see a 40K rendition of a model that used to be an epic model first, you know, you really have a vision in your head of what it's supposed to look like. And that thing had this massive missile on top. And I was kind of hoping to see a bigger missile on that. But, I mean, other than that, it's a nice-looking piece. I can't really complain. I'll tell you what.
What you really want to see, admit it, what you really want to see is you want to see one of those ICBMs that the Russians
would
march down the
street.
That's
exactly what I wanted to see. Granted, yeah. They probably charged $200 for that plastic kit, but,
hey, but
I'd buy it. You're damn straight I'd buy it.
Absolutely.
At least one. I thought that the Wave Serpent kit is looking mighty fine, I got to say. The new turret they put on there is very impressive. The Night Spinner looks good also, and I also really like the new heavy support platforms for the Eldar.
Yes, they're really shaping them up to give some more dimension, some more feeling to the model instead of just the Wave Serpent and a couple sprinklies on top.
Yeah, absolutely. I was very impressed with the kits. I mean, they look nice. I can't wait to get my hands on them, to be honest.
And you know, I don't know how you feel about it, but you'll chime in here. But what are your thoughts on all these models that us as veterans had? excuse me. All the models that as veterans we thought about and we had to build ourselves, you know, like the Death Strike, or we only saw an epic form, so we had to recreate them on the battlefield if we did like a 10,000 point game pre-apocalypse stuff. How do you feel about that nostalgia actually being put onto a real model?
Oh, like the scratch build type thing? Is that what you're talking about? Or
well, now that is leaving and you can actually go buy the models. I mean, this goes for Orc Stompas, the Bane Blades. I mean, for me, going back in the past, you know, if I saw an Armorcast Bane Blade, while it was like the skies opened up and angels came down and there were trumpets all over the place, and then it was even more miraculous to see someone have actually made their model. Well, now you got some money on the checkbook, you can go get it.
Yeah, you know, and I guess it kind of takes away from that hardcore hobbyist having that super special thing that they put their, you know, heart and soul into to get on the table. But on the other hand, you know, I think it really expands the game having all of these things that, you know, were only in your wildest dreams before be, you know, available for the right price. I think it's a good thing. I think it deepens the game. It makes it more rich. It makes it, you know, it makes the background really come to life. And I really like it.
So you're a big Apocalypse player then?
You know, I haven't played it a ton. I would play it a lot more if I had more time. The games just take so long to play that I only get a chance, you know, a couple times a year maybe to get an Apocalypse game in. And it's not because I don't like it. It's just strictly because I don't have, you know, 4 hours to throw into one game.
Wow, because I that's almost all I do. Except on our chapter night, we'll get in small one, but then I'll drive down to Globals and get myself in an Apocalypse game. But yeah, I'm always more amazed to hear people say that because Apocalypse is my frame of reference for 40K.
Well, sure. I mean, like, I love the rule set, and I think it's a great idea. When it first came out, I was playing it almost every week, but, you know, things have changed, and I don't have quite the free time I used to have, so I got to pick my gaming quality a little bit as I go along.
Yes. The older you get or the more involved you get with life in general, the quality of the game takes more importance than
absolutely
the quantity or anything else.
I think you can almost say the older your kids get, the less free time you got to put towards the games.
Yeah, true. So in relation to that, what is a quality game for you? What is it you're looking for when you sit down at the table?
You know, when I sit down at the table, first and foremost, I'm looking to enjoy my time with the person standing across the table away from me. You know, back in the day, you know, that was sometimes secondary. Sometimes I was going for, you know, a good, hard, competitive game. Didn't really matter so much of who was across from me. But as I've gotten older and my time has become less and less, it's more important to have a lot of fun while I play. Winning is now about fourth or fifth on the list.
So are you pretty choosy about your opponents going in?
Yeah, I'm very choosy nowadays about who I'm spending my time with, for sure. In fact, the Prophet and I have been spending a lot of time the last few months. We've been replaying a lot of the scenarios in the back of the Siege of Vrax 1 book. And that's actually been a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a really a big change of direction playing a game where one side has a decided advantage over the other, where you're not necessarily playing for the win, you're playing for a moral victory in there somewhere.
And those, and that is the way I like to play it. It's not about taking the objective. It's about, you know, maybe you only have one model left, but he didn't get it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you're outnumbered, you know, 3-1, and you're going to do your best to make sure that somebody's walking off that battlefield at the end of the day.
Right, yeah. And Vrax. Vrax is very much like Storm of Iron right out of that book. And especially with Prophet's Iron Warriors and you with Imperial Guard, there's no reason why you can even use that and not recreate the kind of a Storm of Iron feel to it.
Absolutely. It was actually hilarious. The last game we played this tank battle that was right out of, I think it was the fourth or fifth mission out of the back of the first book. And one of the things that we've been finding really entertaining is that the first book was written for fourth edition. And we're sitting here trying to play fifth edition rules with it. And talk about a very difficult task of blowing up a Layman Russ with another Layman Russ. I think we went through, seven turns of the game, and I think a total of four tanks were blown up.
Wow.
Everything else, they were just bouncing off each other the whole game. It was pretty funny.
It's remarkable how that stuff kind of just happens, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I don't ever have that kind of game. I've seen them, you know, of course, but the games I play, there tends to be a wipeout on my side, a miraculous, like, complete demolish. So,
like, you're demolishing the other guy, or you've been demolished?
Oh, I have been demolished. Okay. I talk about this game a lot, or hint at it even on this cast a couple times, where I've lost in the first half of the first turn, and me and Global were playing. It was his Khorne Berserkers versus his World Eaters versus my Word Bearers, and we played the table long ways. I did the infiltrate, quick moving army, and so there we were on a Cities of Death or a heavy city terrain board, and I infiltrated all the way up almost maybe a third of the board in, thinking I'm going to get a good assault on him. And sure enough, and we were about like a 3,000 point army, and unbelievably lucky, he rages every model.
Oh, wow.
Every model raged. And it not only did it rage, but it did enough to get into contact with me. So in the first half of the first turn, we were in assault.
That's crazy.
And of course, yeah, so of course I lost. I mean, there you just didn't have
yeah,
a chance.
You don't really want to get in so early with World Eaters.
No, and I think we were in fourth edition, so it was a little freaky then.
Okay,
too,
sure.
Because the assault rules were pretty nasty then, especially flavored for the
absolutely
World Eaters side.
They were good at it, still are.
Yeah. So let's shift gears a little bit here. You know, we talked a lot about 40K because, you know, of course that's the big flavor. But you kind of coming from a little more well rounded hobbyist, and also having been an outrider in the past. What's the Lord of the Rings? Where does it fit into your game's lifestyle?
You know, it really doesn't. I got into it a little bit back when I was an Outrider because it was one of their core systems. So I was kind of obligated to learn the system and to be able to teach other people how to play the system. I've played a few times. I got to say that honestly, the system is very well designed. It's a great system. If someone is into fantasy and looking to get into a miniature, you know, tabletop war game, I think the Lord of the Rings is a good choice. Unfortunately, it's just really not for me. The army I did dabble in, other than, you know, the box set, I had to have a painted box set so I could run demos. But the Dúnedain, the Rangers of the North, was the army I chose to go with. And mostly that was just because it was the least expensive to get into.
Rangers, the Dúnedain, you know, it was like in the early phases of the game, it was like maybe 7 miles.
Yeah, yep, and that was exactly why I went towards it. Yeah,
but they were awesome. I mean, each model was like what, 50 points?
Yep, it was a bunch of.
I mean, they could demolish everything.
Bunch of little Rambos running around the field.
Yeah. Well, you know, I thought a lot about this because I do love Lord of the Rings, and I even play War of the Rings.
Okay, cool.
And the War of the Rings, if you play fantasy, you will love the War of the Rings.
Yeah.
It is an awesome system.
And from everything I've seen and heard and read about it, it does sound like it's an awesome system. And, you know, and I'm not a fantasy lover by any means. So if I was going to play a fantasy game, I would definitely be open to looking into that.
Yeah, it's don't fool yourself. The Lord of the Rings game, I think the reason why GW hangs on to it as long as they do is because it scratches their hero hammer itch. You know, it's obvious through both the other systems that they love their heroes, but having felt that pain in 5th edition fantasy and slightly in 3rd edition 40K, they've toned their heroes down in those games. But in Lord of the Rings, nope, it's all about the hero.
Yeah, sure.
War of the Rings brings another aspect to it, so where the hero is powerful and you can smash stuff, you still can lose it in the end. But yeah, it's a great system.
Sounds cool.
But one of the things I've often thought about is the reason why for vets like you and I, the reason why that game we like it and it's great, we have nothing against it, but we don't play it, it's because we didn't grow up with three games.
Oh, for sure.
But you look at the younger hobbyists, they've grown up with three, so for them, it makes sense. They just, okay, yeah, tonight I'm going to play War of the Rings, tomorrow I'm going to do this, the other day I'm going to do
that. Just kind of fact.
But for us, it's like, yeah, it's just the way it is for them. And as I thought about it, I'm like, well, why can't that be that way for me? So it is, but yet even still, I never get
it. It's hard to find the time when you got a family, for sure. You know, one other reason why I think Games Workshop has not been quick to drop that, you know, the Lord of the Rings game is because you still got two more movies coming out here in the next couple of years. You know, you got The Hobbit, and that's going to be a two-parter, and it's still going to draw a lot more people into the hobby, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, true. Good point.
Yep, it's just the Hobbit's going to come out, and everyone's going to be all crazy for Lord of the Rings again. You know, it's a good marketing design.
So going back to 40K and the Spearhead, we kind of got a little off track there, but what are your plans? What do you plan on putting in your army out of that?
You know, I haven't the slightest idea of what the Spearhead rules are going to encompass. I mean, a lot of it will depend on that. I mean, I got a bunch of Layman Russes assembled, ready to rock. I got Chimeras ready to rock. For the 40K Fight Club Painting Challenge, my June project is going to be my Forge World Bane Blade that I've had sitting on the shelf here for a couple of years. I got it assembled, and it's been dying for some paint, so I figured, you know, what better time than now. So that'll be added to my list of tanks I can bring to the table and unleash on some people.
So where do these supplements fit for you in the regular game?
I dig the supplements. Absolutely love them.
Yeah,
absolutely love them. I've gotten a few of the games of Planet Strike in since that's come out. I've really enjoyed those. If it wasn't for Paul and I playing in this Vrax campaign, we probably wouldn't have gotten quite a few more games of Planet Strike in. I enjoy Cities of Death. I enjoy Apocalypse. I've also been really enjoying this new, even though it's not really a expansion, but the Battle Missions book has been very cool.
Yeah, yeah, the Battle Mission book I think is a good book. I have those missions are deceptively easy, and I fought one of the Tau ones. I think it's the retreating action or something like that. That is not a good mission to fight against. they can really. They can really do some damage.
Got a little bit of an advantage there, huh?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do.
You know, one of the things I really like about the Cities of Death and the Planet Strike and those kind of things is, you know, those types of the games are usually the kind where you talk to your opponent leading into the game, not the day of, but hey, you want to get together this weekend and play some Planet Strike. Okay, let's play 2,000 points. You're attacker, I'm defender, and we're going to play mission number 5. You know, and then you go home and you whip out all your models and spread them on the table and you take a look at what you got and what you think he's going to bring, and then you build your list from there. It adds a whole another dynamic, you know, to building your army list and playing your game. That planning stage can be a lot of fun.
Yes, yes. And that's what I enjoy about fighting against global when you set up a game a week in advance, you know, there's always this dialogue back and forth about what you're doing, and he'll send me a message that says, damn, I'm up to 9,000 points. Want to go that high? So yeah, there's always that the list building can be fun when you're almost must like you're mustering your army.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's also one of the awesome things about the domination table for those chapters that are partaking in that. One of the biggest things behind the table is the metagame. You know, it's like, oh, I'm going to be playing Bob this week. Well, what the heck does Bob own? He has, you know, he has armies A, B, and C. well, what can I take that would do well against these armies? You know, you have, you know, no idea what models he's going to be bringing to the table. And when you're not bringing an all-comers list, when you're basically customizing your list to your opponent, it adds a whole another dimension to this game.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you have to build towards a certain mission, I always likened the domination table, the whole challenge phase, to be like Mech Warrior, when the clans would have to bid for who had the right to fight the battle or something. And the lower you bid, the better your chances are to win. But if you had too low of a bid, you might not have enough resources.
Yep.
So I always felt like going in, you had to judge the right resources in order to fight the battle correctly. But you didn't want to overstep your hand, otherwise you might give away too
Absolutely.
Much. So, what do you think about the next codex? You know, we were talking about Dark Eldar there for a little bit about the new book, and then Global all of a sudden dives in with a little hidden nugget out there on the internet about.
Yeah, Global's got to be right. You know, I think just the simple fact that what's the name of that flyer in the Blood Angels book? The Sky Raven or
Storm Raven?
That's it. Thanks. The fact that wasn't ready for the Blood Angels release, I think just means that they're going to come out with that next codex that is ready for the Storm Raven release. There's just too much money sitting in those boxes, you know, coming out of that production facility for them not to jump on that as soon as possible. And not only that, but you're going to have this Storm Raven that's going to be going out to way more players than who are going to be buying the Dark Eldar miniatures.
True. So what do you think about – it didn't get too much play in the discussion, but how do you feel about the Demon Hunters being their own book and not like a big inquisitorial book?
Oh, sort of the Grey Knights rather than just the Demon Hunters?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, the Grey Knights, I like the idea of them having their own book. They're going to have to come up with some new stuff because, you know, what they have is nowhere near diverse enough to complete a whole codex with.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of, I pulled out some of the old the Black Library novels, the only thing I can see is they're going to put a chaplain in there. They're going to come up with, you know, two levels of a captain, maybe a chapter master kind of thing with a bunch of heroes.
Yeah, you'll have some kick-ass special characters in there for sure. Brother Captain
yep.
Stern will be average.
Yes, right, exactly.
Which, that'll be really cool, by the way.
I mean, anything else? Right. Right. But I can't really think of much else. I mean, they did it already with their fast attack, other than maybe jamming in Inquisitorial Stormtroopers or variations of that theme. I can't really think of much else. I mean, I personally think if they do the Assault Marine Terminator or Grey Knight and all those different flavors like the standard Marines have, I think the Grey Knights would lose their universality,
you know,
to me.
And it would also water them down and not make them the super cool thing that they are. You know,
they're
not supposed to be.
One guy does.
Yeah, they're
all.
Not supposed to be standard Space Marines with jump packs and this kind of thing. They're above and beyond that. The elite of the elite.
Right, which is why I really thought a single book was more appropriate, because then in that, you know, you take an Inquisitor, and then just like they do with the Marines today, you take a certain hero, and based off that, it flavors the rest of your army. So you take an Inquisitor, you war gear him a certain way, he becomes a Demon Hunter. And then from a Demon Hunter, you can take these specialized teams that go after Chaos in that respect. Or if you take an Inquisitor, equip him to be a Witch Hunter, now you get this track. And I kind of thought that fit better, but I'm having a hard time in my mind trying to figure out how they're going to pack a Grey Knight Army,
yeah, and
make up.
I agree. It's going to be that's a tough challenge. I mean, you're really talking about if they're going to go that route. I mean, you're really talking about either A, including, you know, your inducted units in the codex in their own flavor. So you might have under fast attack, you know, assault Marines and a Hellhound or a, you know, a Sentinel, you know, those kind of things, you know, and, or a unit of deep striking Grey Knights kind of thing. They could go that route, but it would seem to be a pretty redundant book with, you know, all their other codexes that are out there. But I don't think by any means that we'll ever see you can pick, you know, these units and these units out of this other codex. I don't think we'll ever see that again.
Right. Well, and you know, you bring that up that they'll replicate units in that book, like you said, the Hellhound and so forth. And I can see them doing that because if you remember back in third edition and some through fourth, they were making you buy the two books mm-hmm. when they could have easily just done a copy and paste in the editing
it's
process.
True.
And they might just very well do that just to say, look, now you only need to buy this one book. And that way, if they change the Imperial Guard Codex or another codex they reference, it doesn't screw up the Demon Hunter Codex.
Yeah, and which is, I think, why we won't see them do that again like they did in the past. I think they felt that they shot themselves in the foot and pigeonholed these rules and tied it to another codex, but then that codex changed and then it, you know, broke all these other rules from the, you know, the old Demon Hunters codex.
Right. So how do you think that puts Sisters then? Do you think they're ripe for a new book right after
I
that?
Would love to see Sisters get their own book. I have Sisters. I think they're awesome. They're a blast to play. They're very unique. They play differently than any other 40K army out there. I mean, they have a stat line like Guard, but armor like Space Marines. You know, the Faith system is extremely cool. I just love that system, and it adds a whole new dynamic to the game. It's something you got to be thinking about all the time. Their vehicles are neat. Their inducted units are really cool, like the Repentia. Who are the Arcoflagellants? You know, the Emptor Priests. All that stuff is just so neat. And it really has a place in the 40K universe. And I think if, you know, you put out plastics of a lot of that stuff, I think it'll sell. I think it would be a very cool thing to add to their collection of codexes. But, you know, as it is, we probably won't be seeing that until late next year at the very, very, you know, earliest.
Right. Because otherwise, other than the Inquisitor, the Sisters really aren't broken. They still stand the test of time.
Yeah, they hold up pretty well. They do. No real complaints about them. And honestly, after the Dark Eldar, we'll probably see another power armored something that's not female, whether it be a Black Templar rewrite, or you know, maybe we'll start seeing some of this the Legion Chaos Codex, you know, like you know, Blood Angels, Death Guard, one of those kind of things.
Right. Yeah. So, where do you think Death Watch fit? This, I think, is going to be a very tough codex to build.
You know, you're right. It would be a very tough codex. You know, I'm not even sure if it would really fit in a codex by itself. I think if I were a designer or one of the designers, what I would probably do is go with the Grey Knights with their own codex and the Sisters with their own codex and then have a separate Inquisition codex that would have, you know, your Demon Hunter Inquisitors, your Witch Hunter Inquisitors, and then your Alien Hunter Inquisitors. And then in that book, even you could have, you know, small units of Grey Knights that you can take. You can have small units of Death Watch you can take, you know, and that type of thing to augment the Inquisitors army on the field.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Make them all like kill team.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of deals.
Exactly. Because you don't have a whole army of Death Watch. I mean, that's just not what the storyline says. The storyline says,
right,
you know, these small groups are, you know, deployed out to these sections where, you know, aliens are running rampant. So they come in this small elite strike force and take them down. You know, I don't see them having Land Raiders and, you know, Thunderhawk gunships and all this stuff. You know, they're smaller than that. They don't have those kind of, you know, those kind of logistics behind them.
So now going back to the first rumor then, Dark Eldar. Now, I have my own thoughts about why it's been taking so long to come up with a new one, and I think first and foremost, it's, you know, they're going to have to redo the whole
line. That's why it's taking so long, for sure.
Well, I think the second reason is that they're struggling with figuring out how the Dark Eldar are unique from the Eldar themselves.
Yeah, that's definitely a tough question. I mean, they really limited themselves with that last codex by having the Dark Eldar come from Komorah, or however you pronounce that city in the warp.
Yeah, I never was able to do
it. Yeah, that's a tough word. I probably would have gone more along the lines of the pirate theme instead of being, you know, the evil Eldar theme, just kind of more being a everyone for themselves theme. But they didn't go that route. They were looking for something a little darker, and which was cool, but limited.
Yeah, and I think going along with your thoughts, I always thought the same thing, because if you remember back in second edition, Eldar in general were this marauding, pirating force. Yep. And the Dark Eldar, they could actually go right back to that route. Say they're a pirate force marauding. They cruise the webways. They hide in there because obviously they're looking for the Black Library. Yep. So why would they have a city? Why would they have a home to sit and listen? But they became this, you know, that on that planet they had, and because of their decadence, they really kind of reminded me of Elric of Melniboné. And that whole Michael Moorcock storyline. I don't know if you've ever
I haven't read that one.
But they really kind of took on that flavor to me of this decadent society. And well, if then they're that route, what happened in those novels is that they just collapsed on themselves. They really didn't care about anything anymore. And that should technically be what happens to the Eldar, sure. Dark Eldar. But they've obviously got a goal and a mission, and that mission is to find the Black Library and dominate their society once again. But yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I think they're going to stick with the same theme that they had in the last Codex. I really don't think that they're gonna reach out real far and stray from what they've already established. I just think that they're going to come up with a lot nicer, cleaner-looking models. I mean, some of the old lines were all right. The witches were pretty cool. The incubi were pretty cool. I actually liked the look of the raider a lot, the skimmer they had. But I thought the warriors left a lot to be desired. The mandrakes were pretty weak. The grotesques were pretty lame.
Oh, yes.
I mean, they have a lot better artists on staff now than the ones who did up a lot of those original models.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly. So, let's talk a little bit about your nemesis here. You know, I remember when we were talking, setting this up, you wanted to talk a little bit about the revelation he gave to us, the fact that he actually at one time owned a Blood Angel.
You know, I really wanted to bring this up. You know, I got to say that you got to feel pretty special, because in the 10 years that I've known Paul DePonio, I have never heard him admit to anybody that he had once owned a Loyalist army. Not to anyone. Yeah. And I think a forum name change is in line for this guy. I really think we should change his name to The False Prophet.
Whoa, The False Prophet, because there was once a false prophet, wasn't there?
There was.
Yeah. That's pretty good. It's very surprising to me, because he's a diehard Chaos fan, and to find out all of a sudden he actually touched, let alone owned, an Imperial model,
I know,
is enough to make you go, what?
Yeah, I was totally shocked. Totally shocked. And I just don't think the Loyalist has ever truly left him.
Yeah, well, does he still own him?
Well, you know, I have never seen him, but that doesn't mean they're not sitting around his house somewhere. He probably gets them out and plays with them when he's by himself and no one else is around. He probably has this little Blood Angels versus Iron Warriors battle, you know, in his basement. And he's rolling the dice for both sides and making sure that the Loyalists come out on top.
I can absolutely see him doing that, kind of working out some strategy or something like that, and lamenting the fact that he's worked himself into this corner where he can only talk about his beloved Iron Warriors.
Yeah, he has a Sanguinius screensaver on his computer, too.
Does he really? Wow. Yeah, The False Prophet is definitely in order. And in fact, I think he needs to put the Blood Angel chapter symbol as his avatar.
That would make a very nice avatar for him, I gotta admit.
Yeah. So, what's up for the Fight Club? I know that you and Paul usually have some big deal coming up. We haven't had one in the last couple years. But is there anything on the pipe that you can talk to us about? What do you got going on for donating members and for the membership at large?
Yeah, actually, seeing that we just had lunch today and we're talking about this stuff, we got a couple things in the pipeline. We decided today that we're going to there was a couple people showing some interest in the T-shirts, and those pictures are probably 5 years old at this point.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to redo some T-shirts. We're going to have some We're going to have something new on the back. The front's going to still look the same with the 40K Fight Club logo on it, or over where the pocket would normally be. The back, we haven't decided exactly what's going to be on there, but it'll be something fun, I guarantee it. We're going to change the color this time. We're not going to go with the dark blue. Not sure what color we're going to go with. So if anyone wants to post some suggestions out into the forum, I'd be willing to listen to what people are interested in. We are going to go with t-shirts for the shirt of choice. We don't really want to get into a bunch of, you know, this guy wants a polo, this guy wants a hoodie, you know, this guy wants a t-shirt. We're going to go pretty much just straight t-shirts. One thing I will be willing to do, though, is for the donating members, if you're interested in getting a shirt made out of the moisture wicking material, like an Under Armour shirt. I will make that available to donating members. Of course, it'll be a little bit more expensive because the shirts themselves are quite a bit more expensive.
Is there an option maybe to get one or two colors instead of just the one color?
Yeah, we could probably work that out. One of the old Lansing chapter members around here, Phil DeWitt, is a graphics artist at a local silk screening company here. So he's who I go through. He's really flexible with me. So, you know, if whatever I want is reasonable, he'll take care of it for us. And he does really good quality work.
Very good. Very good. That's good to hear. Cause it's always fun to get your swag. We haven't had too much of that.
Yeah. Before. You know, last year we did those, wound markers and the measuring device out of that company in Poland. And, tell you what, it can be kind of difficult working with people overseas at times, especially with the time change and the postal system and those kind of things. That ended up just being a nightmare. So I don't know if we'll be dealing overseas on something like that anytime soon. For the t-shirts, we're just going to keep it here local in Michigan, and things will go a lot smoother, I guararantee it.
Well, you used MicroArt Studio.
We did. You know, and
he's usually pretty reliable.
Yeah, they did quality work. We don't have any complaints about the finished product. It was just, you know, getting the finished product that was the big problem.
Yeah. I've bought a lot of his miniatures when his sculptor moved on and actually has his own store now. But I never had any problem getting them, nor problems with the complaint. But like you said, if there was a delay, you wouldn't know because of that time difference.
Yeah.
And it might be 3 days before he got to his email to answer.
Yep.
But to him, it's like, well, I just got to my email. What are you talking about? And, you know, it's also kind of a realization that half the world doesn't live on their computers like we do.
Absolutely. And, you know, and not to mention, you know, he's got a lot of orders to fill. I mean, he's a busy guy. And answering email is honestly not super high on the priority of a small business owner.
Right. So, to wind things down a little bit, I'm gonna take a book page out of Global's book here, and I'm gonna give you a couple of 40K words, and you tell me what do you think? What's the first thing on your mind? How about the Leviathan?
The Leviathan, evil mass Tyranids.
Tyranids. Well, why is that?
Oh, High Fleet Leviathan.
Oh, good point. Here I'm thinking of the Titan, the movie.
Oh, there you go. That's a total another thought. That would be a really cool model, actually, if someone actually got the ambition to make one of those. It would be every bit as expensive as a Reaver Titan, though.
Yeah. Let's see, Necrons.
Necrons. Very cool army concept. Very interested to see where they're going to go with it. I think they can do a lot with them. They were never really my particular taste, but they always used to give me fits on the field of battle in the previous edition. I don't think it would take much to get them competitive in 5th edition. And I think they can do a lot with it and make them a very viable army.
I always felt that anybody that played Necrons needed to speak like Arnold Schwarzenegger during the whole game.
That would be awesome.
I always thought that should be a rule.
That'd be Bach.
So, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's how they should get their role based on it alone. How about the Hrud?
The Hrud? They're the Space Gaben, right?
Yeah, so, exactly. Do you want to see that army?
I'm not dying to see it. You know, I really wouldn't mind seeing a new race. If they did it right, it could be pretty cool. But I'm not drooling to see space rats.
What kind of new army would you like them to see or like them to do?
You know, I think it would be really cool when they redo the Tau Codex to add another alien race to the Tau Empire. I really liked how they did that with the Vespid in the last release. First, they started out with the Kroot in the original, and then this last one, they added the Vespid. You know, the rule set didn't really work out for the Vespid, but the idea of adding, you know, a new race to the 40K universe without adding an entire codex to the 40K universe was a really cool way to go about it.
Wow, that is a pretty good idea. Yeah, because then you don't upset the apple cart so much.
Yeah, and you know there are already so many choices out there for people to play. You know, it comes to a point where you know you start to get to that point of diminishing returns. Where okay, well we're going to put out this whole new model line. You know, is that going to bring you know new players to the game, or is it just going to take sales away from you know this other segment of 40K sales? You know, are we going to sell three fewer Land Raiders this month because they're buying this new race? And you know, with the number of choices they have out there, how many codexes are there? There's got to be what, a dozen?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's a lot of variety. It really is, and there's really not much reason to start adding new races when you have so many established codexes out there that could really use an update to go with this rule set.
Yeah, that's a good point. I never thought about adding another race to the Tau, but that could be fun. Fill another gap that they might be missing.
Well, for sure,
which is Tau-ish.
You know, fix the Vespid rules.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're not the best in the world. That's
make
sure.
It something somebody would actually want to take. You know, and I really think that they've been doing a much better job of that in the last, you know, with the 5th edition codexes. You don't find units in the new codexes very often that just aren't likely to see the field. Almost everything in the codexes now have a place, and they will, you know, they'll give you returns on your investment in points.
Yeah. Huh. Good. I like that. I like that idea of a new race in there, and it would be feeling like they're cramming something else in if they didn't either eliminate a race, like finally kill the Tyranid or something like that. But I think that would irritate more people.
Yeah, you don't want to cut stuff out. I mean, people have put a lot of money and a lot of time into what they have. So you want to let them keep what they got, you know? And I mean, the HRUD inside a Tau Empire Codex would be pretty cool.
Yeah, that would be kind of cool. Make them the sniper force or a scouting force. Because the Pathfinders are not really that good at what they do. They don't survive very long, is what I mean. You know, I see a lot of people taking them because they get a lot of marker lights on the table and so forth, but they don't survive.
No, but they weren't designed. They weren't designed to survive.
True. Good point. Well, I know how much it irritates people when I cut this off, but you are going to be put into the same podcast as Pat.
Oh, sweet.
And this podcast is already going to be 2 hours long with him in there.
I had a good time. I'll have to do this again sometime.
Yeah, definitely. I really got to get the other chapter masters to respond, because pretty soon what will really get this dynamic going is if we get more than just one other person on the line, if I can get like three or four. And then if we can do like a chapter masters roundtable,
that'd be a lot of fun. I wouldn't mind a Deponio and I coming on once together too. That would be a kick.
Right. Yeah, that would be good, because then you get a dynamic of three people talking back and forth. It becomes
different. For sure. Yeah, it would definitely add to the program. I just wanted also to commend you. I put this on the forum. I know you saw it, but I really thought that you and Jeff did a top notch job on that last one. That was a very good episode. It had me smiling and cracking up, and it was good stuff.
Yeah, that was fun. I've got some other creative ideas to do some other casts.
Oh,
like
cool.
It was
neat.
And that was all him. That wasn't me. So I was a little surprised when I came over, and he said, no, I got ready to go, as you can hear in the bloopers. And he goes, no, you don't talk.
Like, oh, okay. Yeah, he definitely kind of took the reins on that. He did a good job. He obviously put a lot of time into his questions and stuff. So he didn't lack in prep.
Yes,
you know, I actually found myself listening to it and taking some notes and, you know, making sure I covered the things that I wanted to talk about, which you got to all of them, yeah. And, it was fun.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, I'll let you go.
All right, sounds good, Jerry.
And, all right,
talk to you soon.
We'll talk
all right,
to
bye.
You.
And now for a special guest in the 40K Fight Club podcast, Fight Night. This is a long time, long known gamer here in the area. He's kind of a diplomat of the hobby in Michigan. So I hope you enjoy listening to him. I've been hearing him get back into the hobby and kind of what drives him and what motivates him to do the game that we all enjoy together. So I introduce none other to you than Pat Pillars, known as Patty, a member of a club called Patty's Heroes. Pat, how you doing?
Yeah, it's been a while. How y'all doing?
So, you know, tonight we're going to talk a little bit about Pat, talk about the hobby for him, how it goes, and maybe get into Pat used to own one of the local stores in the area, and we'll talk a little bit about that and how the hobby has changed for him and what's drawn him back into the limelight again, as it were. So, Pat, you know, talk to us a little bit about the stores you owned, the two of them. I mean, I guess it was Patty Games and then it was Scorpion's Lair, and give us a the Fight Club's grown a little bit. They have like 12 chapters now. So talk to us, let everybody know who doesn't know you a little bit about yourself.
Oh boy, start from the beginning. Okay. You know, like everybody else, started playing Warhammer Fantasy Battle way back in the day, the role-playing game. By the time we got into the 90s, started doing a lot of the miniature stuff. One day a friend of mine, Tim by name, says, "Hey, we got to start our own store." I thought he was nuts, but we did it. And we started Patty's Games here in Saginaw and ran that for 2000 through 2004. End of 2004, we moved to Flint and had Scorpion's Lair there for about 6 months. And then we had to close. And a lot of reasons. Primarily, for those of you who know me, that was the year I was really, really sick. And after spending a week in the hospital and all that fun stuff, it became really hard for us to continue in the store. Not that we didn't love it, and not that we wouldn't do it again, but that was our big issue back then was health. But we started out with the store. We had an absolute blast. I can remember the first day that we opened. It was a Monday, of all things. And I was on DW's website, and they had a thing where you could, like, find players in your area. And I went, "Hey, this is Pat. I'm known as Patty. I have Patty's Games. We're in Saginaw. If you're near the area, you know, give me a shout back. Here's my email." And I got two responses right off the giddy up. And the next day, both those gentlemen came in, sat down, played a game of Warhammer Fantasy, and that's where we started. And it was just a whirlwind after that.
So what? Let's dive into that a little bit. You know, I told you that not all the questions would be scripted, but you know, it's usually a hobbyist, the pinnacle of their dreams to actually start a store. Let's not burst anybody's bubble, so to speak, but what are the real challenges of actually running a store? A lot of us speculate on why stores close, and not to, if it, you know, apologies if it kind of brings up some bad memories or whatnot, but kind of what are the challenges that most hobbyists don't foresee or kind of gloss over and really kind of think, that's not really that big of a deal?
There's a lot of factors. Owning your own business is not for the weak, let me tell you. You really got to work hard at it every day, all the time. And if it's something you love and you love to do, it's the best of all worlds. And we love doing it. We've had other businesses, before that and during that. We were in the car wash business. We built car washes all over the state. Steph was into, she had her herb business and, which is funny, I realized. But she sold herbs and candles all over the place.
Yeah, herbs.
Remember the candles in the back?
Oh yeah.
And you know, we were used to having our own business, so it wasn't that big of a deal to kind of take that next step and let's start a game store. We had no idea what we were doing, no idea what we're getting into. Our retail experience was usually on the other side of the counter, so to speak, the other side of the wall, not owning but doing, being a worker, and it was a big eye opener. And I think the biggest thing for us it was a health issue, it was a change in venue, I guess, if you will. We lost our opportunity to stay in Saginaw. We went down to Flint. Flint was a great experience. The problem primarily with that was I was still sick. Even though I was in the hospital for a week, I had about a month of recovery, at home, didn't help. I had a relapse in December, beginning of December before Christmas that year, 2004. And Steph says, you know what? It's too much. We can't do it. And so we stopped. It was tough, but to put it in perspective for people who want to do it, it is a gamer's dream to own a store. But I'm going to tell you that it takes a lot of work, a lot of effort, and a lot of money. It takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of nights going, geez, can I pay an electric bill next week? I better sell some stuff. And being a gamer, the last thing you want is somebody down in your face going, hey, buy the latest. Because you don't like it as a gamer, but when you take a step around that counter, you got to start worrying about, like you said, paying the electric bill, paying the rent. And first time around was a learning experience. Second time around would be a lot easier.
So does it, you know, a lot of people that run events don't realize that when you run the event, you kind of lose the joy of the game because you're not worried about the playing the game, or you're worried about the event coming off big. So you end up being the big elephant in the room and making decisions people don't like and so forth. Do you get that kind of flavor when you're the guy running the store now, that, you know, do you lose perspective, or is it, you know, in this role today, I own the store, in a few hours when I'm off shift or when I've got some downtime, maybe I'll become the hobbyist?
You have to learn to mix both, I guess. I know that when we ran big events, and we ran some pretty big ones, with a lot of help, that was a big key for us, was getting a lot of help from everybody around us. And beauty of gamers is they're willing to help. And that was a big thing for us. But you have to kind of, and I know I made decisions that people probably were not real happy with. But when you run a big event like that, which, by the way, was my greatest satisfaction, was running a big, huge event, having 50 guys in a room playing 40K or fantasy, whatever we were doing, that, and having it go off and having it go off well and people having a good time, that was my biggest kick out of it right there. And not just tournaments, but we also did some event days, we did some campaign stuff. That, to me, was a lot of fun. What you do miss is being a player, you know, and being a hobbyist. You got to learn to balance it, and it's hard to do, but you can do it. You can do it.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the hobby for you. It's always been a mystery to me, but what's your favorite army? First of all, actually, what's your favorite genre of the game, 40K or fantasy? And I guess now with Lord of the Rings, I don't know if you've ever played their Lord of the Rings-based games. But
yeah, I played Lord of the Rings. I love the models of Lord of the Rings. I like the game system. But it's probably my least favorite. If I have to pick one, I guess I'd pick fantasy, probably because I started in that, and I like the game system maybe a little bit better. On the other side of the coin, the 40K fluff I really like. Favorite army is always going to be the Bretonians. It's always going to be those guys. Always like horse guys, you know?
Right. Right. So, what really gets it for you about the Bretonians? Why do you like those? I know me and you both are part of the Great Lakes Warhammer League, and you've always, whenever you reply to the boards there, you're always in character. And it's kind of nice to see in a world full of tournament-minded folks that somebody can still get the joy of just playing the game and having some fun with it. What about the Bertorians really kind of stands out for you?
A lot of levels of it, I guess. It's a funny story how I ended up picking them. Way back in 5th edition, back 15 years ago, I guess. You had the box set. You got Lizardmen, you got Bertorians. And I was weighing. I like the Lizardmen. I like the Bertorians. My son says, "Oh, lizards. I love lizards. I want those." Okay. Decision made. Which was pretty easy for me to make because right. I like the knights. I love the history, the fluff that they came up with them. And frankly, not a lot of people play them. And I was really surprised. A lot of people like Chaos. I like Chaos, 40K and Fantasy. I play those as well. But there's just something about the knights, the chivalry. There's a little bit of the magic side of it, the Lady of the Lake, that whole mythos, mixing in with the French side of it. It appeals to the middle-aged person in me, if you will.
Do you get an Arthurian kind of feel out of the Bertorians?
Yeah, a little bit. There's that in there with a good healthy dose. Think of Agincourt or something along that period of time, but with a really older Arthurian Celtic mythos in there as well. Kind of mix it to it almost that's what it appears to me that they've done. And yeah, you definitely get that part of it. They're heroes, they're knights, they're horses. They got the peasants and they're peasants, you know.
Right.
You know?
Right.
What do we need to do, right?
Right. Well, the one thing I liked about fantasy, you don't see this in 40K so much, but fantasy, you really kind of get the British humor coming out. And if you're clever enough, you can pick it out. Probably the most overt one is Glumplin's Fighting Cocks. I mean, what is that? I mean, and if you ask a GW employee from Britain, they'll kind of smirk at you, thinking you don't get the inside joke. But there's an inside joke to that one, and it's rather right in your face. But with the current Bertorian army, I don't remember what it is, but it's like the relic, the guys that are carrying that dead knight, and they're pretending to be his horse.
Right, the Grail relic.
Yeah, the Grail relic. I mean, to me, that just screams Mighty Python.
It does, and it doesn't. There's a humor in it if you look at it from that perspective, but if you dig enough and deep enough into not only Games Workshop fluff but the fluff of the time, it was quite common for a local knight to almost be sanctified. So for them, especially in the Middle Ages, a saint. Their bones, their swords, they preserved all that. It's still preserved in churches to this day. And I think that's what they're trying to do. I mean, there's a little bit of humor in it because, I mean, you got peasants with a rotting knight and a rotting horse and they're pushing them along. That seems kind of silly, but it fits their fluff. What really gets me about the Bretonians is you have the different levels of knights. You have the high knights, if you will, the high chivalry. Right on down to the common hedge knight, the hedgerow knight, which was a big aspect of Norman knights and in Normandy. And from that aspect of, you got the poor peasant knight, if you will. He's still a knight. He's a landowner. And he has these, peasants. And when the Lord calls him, he gets his peasants and gets them in a row and they follow the horse and away they go. And they go fight. Very Middle Ages, very much in that whole genre, if you will. Very historical. And you're right. I think with the English side, their sense of humor, their outlook on things. I think they still want to go back to Henry V era.
Right.
They miss that. A little bit. I think it's just that. That aspect of it. I mean, you got your typical dwarves and your elves and the good guys and the bad guys and 40K does too. It's separated out a little bit. I guess in their approach, and I'm more European approach, I guess, in the game than American approach. American approach seems to be, let's play 40K. We got big tanks, big lasers. and big mutant guys shooting each other, which is fun. Don't get me wrong. It's a lot of fun. But it almost seems like the real effort to stick in the fantasy side of it comes through. For instance, Mordheim, another one of my games that I absolutely love. Blood Bowl. You want the humor and fantasy and all that?
That's right. You're a big Blood Bowl guy.
Oh, yeah. I love that game. I mean, for me, the specialist games have always been huge on my list of things that I love to do. Just because of the humor. I mean, let's face it. You're on the pitch. You got these crazy guys wearing spikes and a spike ball playing a game. And it's quite common to have a player get killed. How's that not fun? You know, it's a beer and pretzels game, but it's a fun beer and pretzels game.
Yeah, and I have to admit, I think you and I've had this discussion before. My favorite version of Blood Bowl was the first one, because they actually encouraged you to break the rules. I remember many games of starting on the pitch with the right number of players and ending it with five more. If you could sneak another player on the board, and nobody caught you. You were good.
It was more wide open. You had the cards. You had crazy events going on. You get in a league with guys who are the right mindset, the right frame of mind where, hey, we're just here to have fun. A Blood Bowl league can be an absolute scream. And I used to do this to people all the time and say, you know how cool Blood Bowl is? And I'd show them a picture and they'd show some of the big tournaments they have in England. And you got 300 guys in a hall and they're all playing Blood Bowl and they're, you know, elbow to elbow and doing the butt brush. And they're all laughing, all having a good time, crazy stuff's going on. And that, to me, is the joy of it. That's the fun of it. I mean, there's other aspects that are fun, but they getting together, a large group of guys, girls, and having a lot of fun playing a game and not being real serious about it. That is the big key. My thought has always been the fantasy side. My experience, a majority of the players are, let's just sit down and have fun, drink a beer or whatever, drink a soda, have some fun. And it's a little bit less competitive, where 40K is a little bit more. And I'm not sure why that is, because it's still the same type of game. I mean, you're still there to have fun, kick back. Whether it's that competitive side.
Well, I see it a little different. I see fantasy as being more competitive, but everybody's comfortable with it and they still enjoy it. They don't get upset over it. Whereas the competitive side of 40K, those guys take that seriously. There's no room for margin of error on that. And the fantasy guys are much more kind of flexible to one degree or another, I think.
That could be. Things have changed so much in the past 5 years. That the focus on things, tournaments, for instance, tournaments next, that the focus on the game has changed a great deal. When I was playing every day, running campaigns or tournaments every weekend, things have changed a great deal. I don't know if it's for the better either, to be honest with you.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. We've actually, on the Fight Club, we've had a number of discussions about the competitive versus the general hobbyist, the guy that just enjoys playing the game to play the game. Let's first of all call a duck and admit the fact that we all like to win our game, right? I mean, we're not going to intentionally sound and lose. But where does the leap off between competitiveness and enjoying the game leave it for you?
I think what happens is now running tournaments, for instance, you'll get a lot of guys, they're there to win. They want to win their games. And that's why you play. That's why you keep score. And I used to do this to people all the time when they were in the store. Hey, just throw some guys on the field. I don't care how many points you got. I'm not going to count how many points I got. We're not keeping score. Let's just play. And they would look at me like I'm crazy. Because 2 weeks from that date, we were having a tournament where you had to follow your P's and Q's and, you know, cross your T's, dot your I's, and you're playing to win, you know. But you'd be in a tournament and you would have folks who were, I'm going out there, I'm going to win. And they get real competitive and real uptight. And you can see it in their face. You can see it in their posture. And I'd go over and tell them a joke just to get them to loosen up a little bit, you know? And you can see that, you get that 1,000-yard stare, you know? They're staring at the table and it's like, my God, if they had lasers in their eyes, the opposing army would be slag, you know?
Right, yeah.
And, like, come on, guys, lighten up a little bit. We're just having fun. Don't worry about it, you know. And for the most part, if you set the right tone, if your group sets the right tone, everybody will follow along. Out of all the tournaments I ran, and I was, it's funny, since we were talking last week, a little bit exchanging messages, I was thinking about this. I was trying to think, how many tournaments have I ran? How many campaigns, stuff like that? I'm not entirely sure. I'm guessing around 25 to 30 tournaments. I don't know how many campaigns. We ran them all the time. So, you know, and 40K in fantasy, not counting specialist tournaments, which we actually ran Mordheim and Blood Bowl Pro Trader tournaments, which is fun. And BFG too, Battlefleet Gothic. But I think it's, you have to set the right tone. And 10 years ago, the tone was, let's just get together and play. You get a few guys that were rogue, gun-ho, I got to go out and win. And they would eventually line up a little bit. But out of all the tournaments I ran, all the stuff I did, I only had one incident where a guy was really confused about the rules. It was from outside of the group, if you will, the big group. And he got really upset. And I watched him take his army and literally sweep it off the table into his case with his arm, beautifully painted army. And I felt bad. I felt like I let the guy down, you know, and I went outside and talked to him. And I told him, I said, hey, look, you can't act like that. I understand the issue involved. I understand your problems. But you can't act like that. You can't do that. We're here to have fun, and you're not having fun. And everybody else in that room, all of a sudden, their fun factor went to zero because you're so upset. So let's work it out, which we did. He's a great guy. He just had a problem with one of the rules that he didn't understand and went back in. And I'll give the guy credit. Like me, I cannot remember his name, but I'll give the guy credit. He went back in. He apologized to everybody, went around, shook everybody's hand, said he was sorry that he, you know, he lost his temper, lost his cool. And that was the only incident I ever had of that happening. And I mean, I know people left and went, God, you know, I was in that tournament, I got screwed or whatever, you know. And they weren't, not everybody was happy all the time. That was the only time I ever seen somebody just really freak out, you know. And it ended up being good. It ended up being good in the end. That's what makes the hobby cool, is you can get upset, you can play to win, but sometimes you just have to take a step back, take a breath. And my perspective is different than everybody else, because when you play all the time, like I did, and I mean literally played just about every day, and some days four games in a day, that's tough, you know. But when you're, I couldn't do it now. But back then, when I was playing that much, it got really, really rapidly to the point where I didn't care if I won or lost. It made no difference to me whatsoever. I wanted to have a good time. I wanted to be competitive. I wanted to have the other guy have a good time, or girl have a good time. And as long as the person across the table from me had a good time, I had a good time. We had a good competitive battle. Hey, win or lose, it didn't matter, you know. Right. And I think players that stay in the hobby long enough will eventually reach that plateau. It's the new guys. Excuse me. It's the new guys who maybe only have a year under their belt or less, who think, I got to prove myself. I got to win. And you can get them to calm down a little bit, because there's so many other aspects of the hobby. It's not just about winning or losing.
Right. Yeah.
There's so much other things you can do. You collect, you paint, you model, you sculpt. There's the fluff side. There's the writing story side of it. Being involved in campaigns, it's hanging out with your buddies, it's meeting new people, making new friends. There's so much other aspects of it that winning and losing becomes irrelevant eventually, because you know what? It doesn't matter if you want a grand tournament or not. It doesn't matter if you want a golden demon or not. The guy sitting across from the table, if he's a cool guy and you're having fun playing, that's all that matters, you know. That's why you do it.
Right.
You do it for the fun aspect.
Right. Yeah, because if you're not having fun, what was the point of it in the first place?
Well, we all have busy lives. Yeah. I mean, we're all doing, working other jobs. We're all doing, you know, we all got kids. We got wives. You know, and we're all trying to have, we've got so much going on in our lives as it is, that when you sit down for that 2 hours or 3 hours on a Friday night and you got the time, you know, you got, you know, the planets align, you got a babysitter for the kids, the wife's cool with it, you know, you're caught up at work and you just want to sit down and have some fun. It's like, you want to have a good experience. So coming with that kind of attitude to the table, if everybody comes with that attitude, that's a lot of fun. Those that don't come with that attitude, you know, eventually group dynamics, they'll get the idea,
right?
You know, and they'll play along nice. Where I think things have changed so much is, even though we're running Rogue Trader tournaments, people are playing in tournaments and being competitive. Grand tournaments were a big thing, you know, they still are, but you know, when we were running tournaments constantly, and it wasn't just us, it was guys in Flint, it was guys in Lansing, it was guys in Detroit. I mean, people running, you can pick up a tournament at least once a month, if not twice a month, easy, for a long time there.
Right.
It was competitive was there, but see, now, I'm gonna say this, Hard Boys is the wrong approach.
Yeah.
And you know what? I can say this, but I'm stepped back from a little bit. I'm not a store owner. I'm not a rogue trader anymore. I can tell you, I can be a little bit critical publicly. And publicly, Hard Boys is the wrong way to go about fostering the hobby and having a good time, because it breeds too much competitiveness.
Well, I'll tell you, the where I get real critical with Hard Boys is that it's where GW is being very overt and kind of disingenuous with their message, where they have always pushed the hobby and always been about the hobbyists. All of a sudden, out of left field, because this like massive tournament, which in their own admission is nothing more than an effort to push 2,500 point armies. It came from Apocalypse. It came from the fantasy version of Legendary Battles, and that's all it is. And proven by the fact that it's not run by their event folks, the guys that put on Games Day. It's run by retail sales. The retail salesman right. put it on. So I mean, it's a poor tournament format, because everyone wonders when everything's coming out. It's half done. The stores and the hobbyists have to put a lot of it together. But you know, that's where I'll agree with you, that it's a poor event from the get-go, because its sole purpose in life is just to push a 2,500 point army on people.
And you know, that's too bad, because I think if you get down in the trenches, so to speak, I'll tell you right now that in my experience, when I said, hey, in 6 weeks we're having a 40k tournament, okay, it's going to be, and then back in the days, 1500, then we went to 1750. And I said, you know, we're going to do this, and the tournament's coming up in 6 weeks. Let's get, you know, we're going to have a paint day on Saturday. Bring your guys in. We're just going to sit down and shoot, you know, shoot the wind, so to speak, have some fun. We're going to paint and, you know, get them armies all set to go, do some repair on some guys, you know, because everybody plays them all the time, so they get beat up. But I'm going to tell you right now that fostered sales, because guys – the last tournament the guy was in, man, I wish I'd have had a Razorback, or, you know, geez, I wish I'd have had this veteran squad, you know, and you know, I ought to pick one of those up. That will foster sales. So you don't need to go to that extra step, if you will. But I'm going to say this, though. One of the things I ran in the store, we had so much fun with, was a Bring It League. And when I say Bring It, it was for 40K. When I say Bring It, you bring a legal army. I don't care what you got in there. I don't care how crazy, you know, cheesy, whatever you want to call it, beardy, whatever you want to call it, you bring whatever you want to bring. And you get all the weird combinations. And we're talking back in third edition 40K when we did this. You bring all the weird combinations, all this strange stuff that you never really played with, because you're always trying to make a tournament-friendly army, a comp-friendly army. I said, hey, throw those ideas right out the window. Bring it. You bring it. If you don't, the guy next to you is going to bring it, and he's going to walk on you. So let's go hardcore. Let's see what we can do with it.
Yeah, and that's and it sounds a lot like the Gladiator tournament. A little less on the additional rules, where you're putting the framework of the game itself and saying bring a list and we'll duke it out, no holds bar.
And you know what? Everybody knew going in what that was. Everybody had a lot of fun. And I played a vanilla Marine army, and I didn't do too bad. You know, I won a few games, not many. But I'll tell you what, though, I had fun. I knew going in, and I was trying to prove a point by playing a vanilla army too. It was just like, hey, you know what? vanilla armies are not as vanilla as you think they are.
Right, right. Yeah, back in third edition when that was always the issue, vanilla Marines versus the other chapters.
Yeah, why are you bringing this? Oh, my God, you got that combination. That's easy. Yeah. You know, because within the rules, it maybe wasn't good comp as far as tournament comp goes, but it's well within the rules. And, you know, we did that. We had a lot of fun. The guy that won it was playing Eldar at the time. And, well, you want to talk about a sick army, but it was fun playing against him because I knew going in, when I played him, I knew going in, like, oh, man, I got my work cut out for me. Let's see what I can do. And it was a challenge. And I told everybody, look, it's a challenge. Let's have fun. Just like challenge boards or any of that other kind of stuff that everybody's done over the years. If you know going in what you expect, it's fun. And you kind of trash talk maybe a little bit. You have a little fun with the guy next to you. And let's one off each other, you know. It's that surprise thing. And you know, I had a couple people say, come on down, play in the Art Boys tournament. And bring a Bretonnia. It'd be great, man. And Bretonnia's are hardcore. Well, okay, if you say so. And I was looking at army lists, and I'm like, how many dragons you got again? You know, stuff like that.
Right.
No, I have no chance. So let's just – it don't look like a lot of fun because everybody was like – looking for that ultimate combination to take everybody out. And, you know, I hear guys taking high elves. They got all the dragons and stuff and techless and whatnot, and they're getting smoked. And I'm like, oh, my God, I've got a couple little damsels in my army.
Right.
And you just techless? I have no chance.
Right.
You know? And you know, I guess you step away from the hobby side of it a little bit, and you go more to let's just push figures on the table. They lose their luster, if you will. Becomes less a hobby, more of a board game. And,
right. Yeah.
I think that's. I don't think Games Workshop ever wanted to do that. I don't think anybody that's been in the hobby for any length of time wants to see that.
Well, that's why they switched in Fantasy from the Hero Hammer of 5th Edition to the way it is now. They didn't like how it became so board game like. Yeah, that's exactly it. So, you know, with that transition a little bit, talking about Fantasy, obviously you've been out of the hobby for a little bit, taking a break. Have you heard the rumors, or not the rumors, actually, there's a new edition of Fantasy coming out now?
Yeah, I did. I've been kind of keeping my eye on it. I'm curious as to how this is going to play out, and I've been looking at it, since we talked last week a little bit there, and we're talking about doing podcasts, and I'm like, you know, I should come up with some thoughts on new editions and books and what's going on, and kind of tell you what I think, and not be afraid to tell you what I think. And
yeah, absolutely. And, yeah.
Well, I'm on the other side of the table now, so to speak. You know, I'm not a I'm a user, a consumer, if you will, not a seller. And I think you should even be honest when you're selling though too, and be straight and fair about it. But I was always diplomatic, I guess, if you will. I think it's a good idea to have a new edition. New editions are fine. I love 6th edition. I'll tell you that flat out. 5th edition was crazy. 4th edition was crazy. Hero Hammer, absolutely. 6th edition was really a lot of fun. 7th edition was okay. The basic rules didn't change much, but what got me was the army books. Some of the new rules that came out with it. I'll tell you right now, strike first is a stupid rule.
Fought some high elves, have you?
I have high elves, you know, and I play high elves, and I guess my theory behind it is if you have to make a special rule for an army to be competitive, you fail. Bit of a failure. It's a minor failure. But then when you take that and you do a army book or Codex Escalation and start giving it to everybody with special magic, special rules, special units, pretty soon everybody's striking first and you're going, well, what's your initiative again? That don't make any sense. And then those that didn't get that rule suffer. And it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. This leads into my theory on if you design a game and you're going to design an edition, it would make logical sense to me. And I honestly don't know how Games Workshop does it, but it would make logical sense to me that if they're coming out with an 8th edition, which is coming down the pipe, then you should have a really good idea, if not already written, your army books. And the reason why I say that is it prevents bulk escalation, it prevents strange rules to make armies competitive, and then it doesn't vanilla everybody out. And that's another problem that I have, is having high elves strike first, then just let them strike first. That's fine. There's ways around that. But don't give it to Dark Elves. Don't give it to anybody else.
Right.
Don't give these special magic items. Because, see, the first books that come out, like Empire, always gets the shaft. They always have, you know? And it's like, what about them guys, you know?
Right. I think the to kind of go along with your theory, let's get beyond the point that GW is a company, they got to make money, so that's their entire point. Well, that is the point. They've got to make money. I think in addition to coming out with new editions every 4 years or so that they have been lately, I think it's exactly what you said. They've churned out all these army books, updating them, and so it's a self-licking ice cream cone they've created, where they've come up with all these new books that they've got to meet with the new rule set, and some of them are overpowered now because they come up with these great ideas and they just got to put them in there. So what they do is they say, instead of what we experienced with the 3rd and the 6th edition, where they throw out a number of rule changes and FAQs over time, and now in addition to your army book and your rule book, you got to bring back like a notebook full of other things that you've got to print off, and God help you if they've just updated something and you go to a tournament and somebody's got like the latest and the greatest that you weren't aware of. They just update the core rules.
Yeah.
But then it's like you said, that either somebody that was cool a minute ago now gets watered down, or now everybody gets the rule that you had as a unique one.
And that's what I love, not only fantasy but 40K, is the uniqueness of the armies, the uniqueness of the races. You know, Skaven have this ability. Tyranids have this ability. You know, and it's only for that ability. Only they have that. Don't give it to anybody else. It might be cool. It might be a neat rule, but let's not water it down and have everybody have that capability, because that takes out some of the diversity of the game, which is what makes the game cool. And I don't want to be overcritical. I think Games Workshop does a really good job on a lot of areas. There's just some things that I go kind of scratch my head and go, geez, boy, this could be so much better. And then it would be, instead of being awesome, it would be, oh my God, awesome. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think that's where, and it's easy to criticize, and it's easy to look at it from across the pond and go, what are you guys thinking? And you don't know, you know? I mean, you don't understand the process. I don't, as much as I'd love to. But it's easy for me to go, well, hey, this doesn't work, this doesn't work. Why did you guys do that? And they go, well, you know, at the time, it was a good idea. Now things have changed.
Right.
You ready for a radical idea about that, about roles?
Yeah, go ahead.
Give away the main rule book for free.
Yeah, that's pretty radical. That's pretty radical.
And I'm going to tell you why. I'm not sure what they're in the business of making money, and they do well at that, and they're successful. How many game companies? You and I both know, and everybody out in the world knows that there's a lot of game companies that went by the wayside because they couldn't make money.
Right.
And it's too bad, because when you got a good product, we have a great product. You have great miniatures, you have great rules, great fluff, great just everything. The whole concept is really cool. And if you don't follow through and make money on it and be able to continue to provide that, then you fail. And you fail not only on a business perspective, but you fail your fans, your customers, you fail the gamer, and that's too bad. So if you have to sacrifice a little bit of coolness, I guess, if you will, to continue going, I understand that. Radical idea about giving away the rule book for free. The reason why I say that is they're in the business of making money. I'm not sure how they make money. You know, what's their biggest income provider, if you will. But I find it hard to believe that a $50 hardcover rule book is going to make or break the company.
Right. I don't think it does. I don't think they make a whole lot of money off the book. I think their models are. Because if you think about it, White Dwarf didn't see a price increase until maybe last year. And
yeah.
I know for a fact in the publishing world, they're not making anything. It's White Dwarf pays for itself. And
right, exactly. And that's the big issue right there is publishing's changing. I know this because I'm really actively involved in that and have been for quite a while. Always have been, really, for that matter, but really the past couple years or so, really into it. And I know they don't make a whole lot of money on it. However, unlike other companies, this company, Games Workshop, has beautiful art.
Yes.
It has beautiful design. I mean, nobody has that. And it's just, or they have it, but they have it in small quantities. And nobody has it to their ability, their quantity, their quality. And frankly, I think a lot of that stuff that they do, you gotta pay artists, you know, they have to eat.
Right.
And the best way to pay an artist is to have a book with their awesome drawings in there and selling it.
Well, that makes your radical idea not so radical then. I mean, if you think about it, GW is almost the Apple computer of the miniature hobbying world, right? They've got the great design, the great art. That's what draws everybody. So why not do that? Give the main rule book out for free, minus art, minus storyline. And because a guy like me, I'm going to want the hardback book, because I don't want to print it out and have a three-ring binder carrying around with me.
Oh, no, me too. I'm going to buy it anyways, but I love the artwork.
And that's it. Put the artwork in it.
Having that option, and that's one of the things with the core games changing, and you get the little rule book, that's an awesome idea. It's a compromise that works. But you have to look at it from, you know, how much does it cost to design? How much does the artist cost? How much do the writers cost? The game designers, the model designers, and then before you even start making models, before you even start producing them, there's a lot of back end cost in it that you got to pay for in some fashion. And giving away your product for free is not a good idea, but it might be one of those ideas where if you didn't have that available, or you had it available but in a very limited quantity, so you're not investing a lot of money into it from the giddy up. I'm going to tell you right now that a guy walks into the store with $50 in his pocket, and you can either hand him a little booklet that he paid, say, $5 for, that has just the basic rules, or it's free, okay, or he already has one, but he still has that $50 in his pocket. And you know what he's going to do? He's going to buy a Redmond box set. He's going to buy a box set, and he's going to buy a couple of paints. And he's going to talk to that guy across the counter. And the guy across the counter is an avid fanatic of the game, of the hobby. And he's going to get fired up, and he's going to go out, and he's going to spend the money anyways. You're going to get the dollars from people no matter what you do. You just have to get them in the door. And once you get them in the door, they're going to love it. You can't help but not love it. You're going to love the game. You're going to love the people. You're going to love the art, the models. You're going to get wrapped up into it. It's kind of like pushing, isn't it? Here's a little free sample. Come on in and you're hooked. And you know what? I think it's a possibility. I think it's something that, I know old gamers, they're still going to buy the big rule book. You know, they're still going to buy, all special edition stuff. The hardcore guys, but for guys who want to be hardcore but don't have the cash, or who are just getting into it, making it easier for them to get into it, I think is good for growth. I always tell the story. I've told you this story. I've probably told everybody I've ever met this story, but I came into the miniature side of it on a demo game. And I was playing the role-playing game, loved it, and guy ran a demo. And for me and my two older boys, long before the little guy was born, years and years ago, and they were like 5 and 6, I think at the time, 7 maybe, and about 95. And guy did this demo, man, and I tell you what, he was awesome. He was great, awesome demo. People were gathering around in this hobby store in Traverse City, and people were like, "Wow, this is awesome! This is a great game!" And everybody's excited. Everybody had fun. I had fun. The kids had fun. So I look at the guy, and I got a credit card sitting in my pocket, burning a hole in my pocket. I'm like, so where do I get this game? Not how much it was, just where is it, and where's the register? You know what I mean? And that's what we did. And you know what? He didn't have any. He had no games at all. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? He says, well, I don't have anything here. I got a couple little blisters over here, but I don't have any games. I'm like, so where do I get one? He goes, well, we could order you one. I'm like, well, I'm from Saginaw, and I'm going back to Saginaw tomorrow. Not going to help me much. And everybody else, you should have seen the faces. I mean, there must have been 20 people standing there. We're talking dads who are reaching in their pockets and digging out cash and credit cards and checks and whatever they could get their hands on because their kids are loving it. They're loving it. And the faces were just, I bought a group of long faces. And that's what I'm saying. If he'd have said, well, look, I got a $25 basic starter set, and I got a big stack of them here. Who wants one? Everybody in the store would have bought one. Guaranteed. They wouldn't even hesitate. It could have been $200 and people would have bought it. They were that excited. What I'm driving at is, once you get people started into it, and you make it easy for them to start with just a taste, a little bit, a cheap way to get into the game, they'll never leave. I'm never going to leave. You know, I might be quiet. I might not say a whole lot. Might be just playing in the basement, so to speak, or getting together with a few guys, but never going to leave. Once you're in, you know what I mean?
Right, right. Well, Pat, we're butting up against it, so I'm going to have to, we're going to have to cut it short here.
And I talked to him. Well, it's kind of what I've been out of it for a little bit.
Right.
I haven't been out of it. I've just been quiet, you know. I haven't been driving around the state, playing tournaments or whatever. But, you know, our local guys up here in Saginaw, we still play. We meet once a month, if not twice a month. You know, the Patty Cereals is still kicking around. We're all old hardcore gamers, you know. And we're still going. And someday, we'll get a store up here. Somebody will get a store up here, hopefully, knock on wood. And we'll go back to doing the crazy stuff we did before.
Yeah.
On that scale. Maybe even bigger. You never know.
Yeah. Well, in the meantime, I hope we see you back on the boards.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think it would be cool to get everybody together, do a big event, big campaign, or just an event day. Not so much per se a tournament, although that'd be fine as well. And you know what? Get all the old crew back together from all over the state, and we can sit down and play and have fun. You know, that would be perfect.
Right. Yeah. Well, with that, Pat. We'll talk to you later, and I hope you have a good night.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, man. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks for having
me. Yeah.
The official podcast of the 40K Fight Club.
Let my master's power consume you! I'll destroy you! Let my mind be guided by saints!
Visit us on the web at www.40kfightclub.com. That's 40kfightclub. That's www.40kfightclub.com or .com.